Good evening. I'm Bob Ift. I'm from Richmond, Virginia. My sobriety date is April 26, 1993. I'm sponsored, and my sponsor's been sober longer than I have, just about a week. And that seems to work out just fine. My home group is the Buford Road Group. We meet every Wednesday night, 7 p.m., in a southern suburb of Richmond called Bonnell. It's a little white church, and it's right across from the old Bonnell Hotel. So if you're ever in Richmond on a Wednesday night looking for a meeting, we'd love for you to come by. Our format's real simple. First Wednesday of the month, we have a speaker. And the other Wednesdays of the month, we discuss a step out of the big book. So, love for y'all to come by. It's an open meet, so you can bring anybody you want. I'm not going to try and forget my manners. I did bring a watch, so I'm not going to bore y'all to tears this evening. I'm going to lay that where I can see it. I want to thank Billy. He called me this afternoon to, again, apologize for not being here, but I want to thank him anyway, again, for inviting me to come out here and be with y'all today. I just attended a little mini conference in Richmond that we had this past weekend, and they were talking about having a watch the evening before your birthday. And I got to tell you guys, I was so tired after the conference, I slept like a baby last night. I didn't need any watch. I got up today, and I'm still sober, so I came on out here. So it was good to celebrate my birthday with you. You know, my wife came with me, and she's out in the parking lot. She hears my mouth a lot, so I don't blame her for not wanting to hear me speak. But I'm glad she came with me. She's a wonderful lady. We've been married since a long time. we stay together, but by the end of August, it'll be 30 years. That's pretty amazing. And she saw a lot of my drunkenness, and she saw a lot of my sobriety. And I'm not sure which she liked better, but I think she stuck with me, unless she leaves, and that's okay too. Better tell you about my drinking. Better. I was a skinny, scrawny little kid growing up. We used a lot in the spring this time of year. And though I love sports, I was no athlete. You can tell that probably by my size. And they started gathering up as teenagers and having these little dances and stuff. And I'd show up and stand on the wall or talk to some other goof and just never fit in. Just didn't feel a part of. And what happened to me was one night, this guy said, "We're going to go out and get some beer and come back to the dance." Well, I didn't know anything about beer. My parents might drink once or twice a year, and that'd be it. And they might have a drink and a half, and leave it sitting around, and get stale and throw it out before they went to bed, and that'd be it. Okay. Normal temperate drinkers, our book calls them. But I had a couple of beers that night, and all of a sudden I knew how to dance. And I had a good time. I didn't get drunk. I didn't fall down. I didn't get puking. But I got to tell you, after a couple of beers, I enjoyed the way that stuff made me feel. And so, anytime after that, if I was going to a party or going to a dance or going to a football game or going to a basketball game or going anywhere, if I could get hold of something and get a few drinks, I knew I was going to have a better time than if I didn't have anything to drink. And I mean, it was a slow deal. I mean, it was just what I did. Borrow the family car, plan to pick up my girlfriend, go to a dance on Saturday, tell my parents I got to run some errands to get ready, I got to go pick up a corsage or something, and I'm over at the ABC store. 10 o'clock in the morning, watching out for some shaky old dude and invite him to buy me a pint and I'll buy his if he'll get me some when I'm 16. Now, last time I checked in Virginia, that's illegal. And not only was it illegal for me to obtain it, it was illegal for him to go do it, but I didn't even care about him. I thought I was doing him a favor by giving him some extra money so he could buy his own pint. Because I had a job, so I was working part-time at 16, so I could make money so I could buy whiskey for the weekend. Because I didn't have a car to spend it on. And my girlfriend, more times than not, would share the expenses of whatever we wanted to do. Because we were making that plan together. Anyway, that's where alcohol took me in a heartbeat. And I didn't even know it till many years later. Is that alcohol will take me to a place where I don't care. I don't care about you, and I don't care about me. What I'm, as my book says, obsessed with getting the next drink. And that's all I can think about. I'm like a hound dog on a good scent. And there's nothing going to get me off of it. And, so I'm doing that stuff, and I don't get in any trouble much in high school. And I worked hard and got to go to New York City with a crowd. And we had a bunch of rules. One of the rules was you can't drink on the trip. And if you get in trouble drinking and stuff, you're going to be sent home. First thing I do, talk to my friends that want to party and say, well, let's go down to the Bowery and get some guy to buy us some whiskey so we can have a party. And I, you know, it's no big deal. We're just listening to some music and doing kids' stuff and ordering some pizzas and having a grand time in the hotel and the problem is that I don't pay attention to the noise of the owl and I'm disturbing people, and they come knocking on the door, and they smell the whiskey, and they say, y'all drinking? Well, whose is this? And I go, well, it's mine. And they go, well, we're going to take it. We don't want you to drink anymore. Well, somebody had to fess up to it. I mean, there had to be somebody, so it might as well be me. I didn't mind letting them know it was mine. And they did not pack up my stuff. They did not send me home on the next train or bus. I got to stay all weekend. And the only thing I learned from that situation was that if I wanted to party in New York City, to keep the noise down. Okay? So, I was okay with that. I'm okay with that. And we just went on and did what we were going to do. And we had a good time and we came back. But let me tell you, by the time I'm 18 and I'm off to school and I got accepted in a nice college where most of the students weren't interested in drinking like I was, there was this crowd that I fell into, and there seemed to be a crowd like that almost everywhere I went that liked to drink and liked to party. We just called them fraternities. We just gave it a name when I was in college. And I fell in love with those guys and did their thing and did that. But I began to become unpredictable with my drinking. In my late teens. By the time I was 20, when I started drinking, I knew I couldn't tell you where it was going to end up that night. I was already having blackouts, already waking up in places I couldn't remember how I got down, already getting sick before the party sometimes even got started because I was already on my way past where I wanted to be to get ready for the party and miss the party, but I'd had my liquor. I'd had it. And when you went to college in the late 60s, there was lots of other stuff going on besides alcohol, but that's all right. We'll leave that for another time. If you don't get the idea that I know anything about that other stuff, I'll talk to you after the meeting. But you're not going to hear it tonight in an AA meeting. Because the guys taught me when I got sober, this is about helping another alcoholic. So the details of what really went on, I'll be glad to share with you. But I'm not going to share but in a general way about some of that stuff tonight. But if I can help you with some experience about it, I'd be glad to. Anyway, we got to doing that stuff on a regular basis, and despite not being able to show up for the party, despite getting sick, despite having hangovers that would make me sick for a day, sometimes a day and a half, by the time the next weekend came around, I would be thinking that I can't wait for the deal to go again. Only this time, I've got a better plan. Instead of buying that fifth, I'm going to buy a couple of six packs and kind of sip on it. Did you ever try and just sip on beer? I tell you. I'm uncomfortable with controlled drinking. That makes no sense to me. Golly. You know. Trying to make two beer last all evening. You might as well just, shoot me. It's just not any fun. For a guy like me. I mean, I just didn't work. And so despite my best plans about how much I was going to drink, you know, if I've got a 6-pack or a 12-pack, I can't predict how much of that I'm going to finish. But it's certainly going to be more than I wanted to do, and rarely was it at the rate I wanted to do it. And so my drinking became real unpredictable. What happened when I started drinking became unpredictable. And I get the grand idea because I'm working 3 part-time jobs and making good grades. It's a fine opportunity to buy a car and be able to drive out there on my own. That, my friends, is alkalogic. And if you don't know what alkalogic is, it's doing insane things despite the evidence to the contrary. Regular people call it insanity. But it was pure insanity for a guy like me, acting the way I was acting, to think that it was perfectly okay to continue to drive around while doing all that other stuff. And yet I did it without any thought or care. Certainly about you, I didn't care. But even about the people I was around that I had some feeling for, because I was getting something from them, and about myself. Didn't care. If I wanted to get up and go someplace, I went and got up and went. And nothing fires me up better than a few drinks. Now, it may be a depressant for a lot of people, but for a guy like me, it fires me up, gets me going. Somehow they describe that as, I believe them, says on the bottle, spirits. I was ingesting in the spirit that got turned on, Bob, and I took off when I got drinking. I love to take road trips, you know. And there were lots of things to go and do in the late 60s, I tell you. Lots of stuff going on. Anyway, I don't know. I graduated in about a month before I graduated. It was either to join the Navy with a fraternity brother of mine, or I had applied to the graduate school, and I went to graduate school. And it was one of those graduate schools you could get a deferment because it was a medical school. And I went to a medical school. And the tight discipline that it took to get through that kind of educational process would sober me up for about 4 days. And I could really hit the books Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. But I had a plan for Friday. I probably had been planning Friday since last Monday or Tuesday. And barring any big deals like classes on Saturday or a big deal due the following Monday, we would find something to go on and party on the weekend, and then I'd hit the books on Sunday and go right back at it. Trust me, that did not get me at the top of my class. But you know what they call the guy that finishes last in his class in medical school? Doctor. And I wasn't in the bottom. I was somewhere in the middle of the pack. And the reason I tried to stay in the middle of the pack is so I didn't stand out. That was the last thing I wanted. That school was to turn on the spotlight and look at what Bob was doing. And as long as I was mediocre and not at the bottom, but not where people would care, I was doing okay. Doing okay. It's probably true in life today is that we can do a lot of things in sobriety that we could never do before. And if you've got goals, I think they're wonderful. Go work towards your goals. I encourage you to do that in sobriety. The guys that I sponsor, I encourage them to have goals and go achieve it. Go toward it. Because the real secret is nobody's watching. And who's going to keep you down? Nobody. That's a between you and God thing. So I encourage you to have goals if you are out there just getting sober. Nobody's going to keep you down anymore because nobody's watching. Anyway, I digress. My disease was progression. And I started with these having even more of those inferiority feelings, those deals about where I can't make it, where I see my classmates and they seem to be getting all this material and absorbing all this information and enjoying what they're doing and being helpful to people and doing volunteer work, and I'm struggling to keep up. And I said, I'll never make it out there. I just don't know how to do it. And so I get this grand idea a month after I graduate from medical school, I'm signed up, and I joined the Navy. And I travel around the world for the next 22 years before I come back to Richmond. And found out that people in the Navy like to drink. They did back when I joined in the mid-70s. They were straightening up a little bit. They were still pretty hard drinkers. They liked to officers, young officers, to come over and develop camaraderie on Friday afternoons after work. And so if I wasn't on call or stuff, I joined right in. And problem is that they went home after a beer or two and were raising families or taking care of other business. And I was there till the guys are flipping the lights and wanting people to go home. Not that y'all would have ever done that, but I mean, that's what I do when I go into a bar. It's that I may intend to have a couple of beers and go have a dinner and maybe go do something with some friends. And I'm there when they're flipping the lights and they're asking me to leave. Because I'm just as comfortable sitting there on the bar stool, betting on dice, talking trash to the girls or whatever, all night, one pitcher after another. I don't know how I stayed out of trouble for so long, but it didn't get me in much trouble, and I was working right hard. And my first couple of years in the Navy, it looked like a grand deal. Got to travel a lot, got to see a lot, met some wonderful people, people who knew how to get things done and were really wonderful. Some of the guys I met in my Navy career that I actually worked with are now professors and on the American board or so-and-so. And I mean, just good caliber, caring, professional people. And so please don't get the idea that they were like me. This is my story. This is what happened to me. And yet I fell into this deal and was able to study and keep up and do some work. And got those certificates and degrees that we need. And I was out there practicing on my own. And on the way, I met my wife down at Portsmouth Naval Hospital, and we got married, and my first son was born down there. But before I got married, I sat on the sofa one afternoon in Norfolk, and I'm drunk at 4:30 in the afternoon, and she's getting ready to go to work. She's got a, it must have been earlier. She's getting ready to go to a 3 o'clock shift, work from 3 to 11. And I'm already drunk, maybe about 2 in the afternoon. And I say, I know we're engaged, but you know, on a Saturday afternoon, most people aren't sitting here drunk. And I'm probably going to sit here all day with the television on and not move off the sofa until I fall over or go out and just pass out in my bed. And she looked at me and said, "Don't worry about that. You're just letting some steam off. I'll call you tomorrow after I get off work and we'll go do something." Now, I don't know about you, but I just, you know, I'd found the right girl. She was going to let me drink the way I wanted to drink and didn't give me any crap about it at that time. That'll change, but, you know, she married me anyway. Bless her heart. I found out why. She took me home to meet her family before we got married. And they're wonderful people. But her brothers drink like I do. Okay? Her father died in his early 50s. And he was a professional who had a hard time making it in his career. And if he hadn't have been so sick, he probably would have still been drinking. But he got so sick he couldn't go buy stuff. And he could only drink what people brought him. So I met her brothers, and we drank a lot alike. And so now I understood why she thought that was just letting off steam. That was the only way she'd ever seen people drink. With no control whatsoever, and no intention of controlling it, and drinking for the sheer effect that only alcoholics seem to get when I take a drink. The world's pressures are suddenly relieved, and everything that was bothering me in the back of my head has just floated off into the sky, and I'm just as comfortable with whatever crowd I'm with, as long as I'm having a few drinks. I'm grateful she got a good dose of Al-Anon weight on when I got sober. And that's helped us. That's helped us a lot. Anyway, I'm drinking like a fool whenever I can. And yet, my responsibilities and my jobs seem to get more and more. And I don't know why. I mean, I just seem to fall into stuff for a long time that's good. And one night, one afternoon, at sort of like this afternoon, nice day, sunny. I've got to be where I've got to be because I'm on call. But I don't want to be there. I want to be somewhere else. And nothing takes me, at least my brain, somewhere else quicker than a drink. And I can be somewhere else in a matter of seconds with a drink. And I started to get better, and I don't know what I had. Normal for me, and it wasn't any big deal. I can't remember what I had to eat that night. And it wasn't even what I liked to drink. But I drank it because maybe they wouldn't smell it on me if I went back to work. And I got called and I had to go back to work. And I'm finished up this operation, and the officer of the day and the master of arms. Now, the officer of the day, he's the guy that runs the hospital for the commanding officer in the Navy while the commanding officer's at home having his dinner and going to sleep. And he's got a badge that represents the guy that's in charge of the hospital. And the master at arms is like a policeman. He's got the authority to arrest people and put people in detention and write up charges. And they're waiting for me when I come out of the operating room. And they say, "Bob, someone thinks that you may have been drinking and we want to talk to you about your operation." And I say, "I finished my operation. My patient's got to get over recovery. Let me write the orders, dictate my note, write a brief description of what I did in the chart so the nurses can take care of my patient, and I'll be right back." And I walked the patient over to the recovery area, which was in a different part of the hospital at ODARC 30, whatever it was, and so they could watch him in the intensive care unit and recover the patient. And on the way back, I knew it was up. And I just did what those guys told me to do. No fight, no argument. Walked with them down to the emergency room, failed the field sobriety test. They drew the blood to prove that their suspicions were accurate. When the blood test came back, they emptied my pockets and told me where to go. Well, I'm sitting where they told me to go the next morning, still shaking from the night before. My boss had called two guys from AA, Bill H. and Mike C. And they came to see me. And Bill was an old drinking buddy of mine. We used to close bars in my first duty station. And he'd gotten sober 7 years before. And I knew he had gotten sober and he was active with AA. And I didn't know a thing about AA. And he brought with him this guy, Mike. And Mike was a department head in that hospital. And I had no idea Mike was an alcoholic. See, when Mike turned around and asked for things to get done, the people that worked with him helped him get things done. And the people that worked under him helped him get things done. Because Mike was an effective member of society because he had found a way to live out there, safe, sane, and sober. And I had no idea how to do that. And because he had learned to do that by practicing this deal we call AA, nobody would have known Mike was an alcoholic unless he shared that with you. So Mike told me his story and what happened to him. And I knew I drank this like Mike did. But I didn't know how to stay stopped. Oh gosh, I tried to stop. Do you ever try those long periods of forced sobriety? Oh my. Restless, irritable, and discontent. I tried that. I didn't think sobriety was was ever going to be there. Because I couldn't stand it. That's why I drank again. I couldn't stand being sober. See, alcohol is a great instant relieval of what's driving me crazy on a regular basis. I know that today. If I take a drink of alcohol, I know that all the stuff that was bothering me before I took the drink is going to be taken away for a short period of time. I don't have one of those experiences that it quit working. I know today that it'll still work for Bob. I needed a different spiritual experience to stay sober out there. And it was not taking another drink. Unless I was going to go back to the way I was living. And I had enough progression where I was done. I didn't have all I wanted, but I had all I could stand. And Mike gave me the news. Bob, you don't have to live the way you're living. And I didn't know that. And Bob, you don't ever have to pick up another drink. And I didn't know that either. And see, what Mike gave me that day was hope. So although I lost my job and I didn't know if I'd ever get it back, although I had lost so much, self-respect, dignity, relationship with my wife, relationships with my boys, didn't know if I'd ever get any of that back. Many guys in that position say, if I can't drink again, dying looks like a good deal. And I didn't have to look at that real hard because Mike gave me the gift of hope. So if I'm ever asked, like Mike and Bill, to go see some guy shaking from his last drink, let me tell you, I've got enough gratitude to go do that because that's what they did for me. My experience is in doing that, I'll jump ahead a little bit, is that nothing keeps me in tune with my sobriety any better than working with some of those guys that just look like me. Still shaking, living in horrible conditions, wondering if this deal will ever work. And I can always give them the same message that was given to me. Straight up, you don't have to live the way you're living. You don't ever have to drink again. But then they told me there were some conditions. You're going to go to a lot of meetings, Bob. And I go, okay. You're going to get a home group. What's a home group? You don't have to know. You're just going to get one. And I was able to say, okay. You're going to get a sponsor. What's a sponsor? You don't have to know. But we think that's somebody that shows you what they did in order to do these spiritual actions we call steps that are guaranteed to change your life. If you do them and practice them as a way of living, we guarantee you your life will change. And I believed them because what I was doing was not working. And so I jumped into the steps. And going to 4 or 5 meetings a week. And I do an inventory and write it down and share it and come out of there feeling great that I'm doing something I've never done before. And went home and pulled the book down and read 6 and 7 and got to that making a list deal about harms done. And it was like the plow hit a stump and the tractor stopped. I was baffled with that list. I had no idea what to do with that list. And that's running around my head, and I'm getting real goofy again and going to your meetings, and I'm not hearing much experience but how to make amends. They're talking about their dog ran away, or their kids are acting up in school, or, you know. They're just not sharing what I want to hear. And I mentioned that to the guy that used to come down from Raleigh to check up on me, because the state was real interested in what Bob was doing at that time. And I asked the guy from Raleigh, he says, Bob, you need a sponsor that's done the steps to show you how to do this. And I go, yeah, that was a grand idea, but I asked three guys and they turned me down. They didn't want to be my sponsor, so I quit asking guys. And he said, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And I go, yeah, this is a whole lot better than it used to be. I can now eat regular food. I can show up to work on a regular time. I can actually get some work done when I'm there. I mean, it's no rose garden, it's no banquet every night, but it's a grand deal compared to what it used to be. And yeah, I want to stay so. Then I suggest that you find a sponsor that's done the steps and show you what they did. And there was this crazy old guy I'd known for years. We were hunting buddies, and I asked Richard to, one night in the parking lot before the meeting, would he be my sponsor? Because I was having trouble with finishing 8 and doing 9. And he said, yeah, sure, Bob. Like it was no big deal. And 2 weeks later, he says, we need somebody to share the meeting next month. You're going to chair the meeting. I go, what, Richard? He goes, yeah, be here an hour early. Make the coffee, set up the chairs. Hour early? He says, yeah, make the coffee so that people that get here a half hour early will have coffee and they can sit down with a cup of coffee and talk to somebody if they got somebody that they need to talk to. You want this place available for the alcoholic. You want to make it welcoming and friendly and available. You're going to be of service to other alcoholics. That was a new idea. See, I thought that it was perfectly okay to come in 2 or 3 minutes late while they were still reading how it works. The meeting hadn't really started. And if I leave before the Lord's Prayer, nobody will pay any attention to that because they say, you don't have to join us. You're welcome to leave. And he's asking me to do things I'd never done before. And when I do these things I've never done before, I'm given a new experience. And the new experience has absolutely changed my life. But had I just refused to take their suggestions, I would have never been changed. I'd be the same old Bob, doing the same old things with the same old ideas, about life and everything else. So I'm grateful that I still have that desperation that when my sponsor makes a suggestion or the old timer comes up to me and says, Bob, it looks like you might want to try this or that, I remain willing and open to their spiritual suggestions. And so I was able to get started on my amends, and it took me many years to finish my amends. There's some amends I haven't made because there's some people that if I went back, it would stir up some hard stuff. And I've gotten some direction from people that it isn't that I shouldn't make the amends, but I might harm somebody in doing it. And I'm not here to save my butt to hurt anybody else today. So I just don't have to interfere with their life. But there are plenty of things I can do to help other people. And as I did that, I became aware that in the 10th step, in doing this daily house cleaning, that was really important. I carry around a list of numbers in my wallet. Handwritten numbers in case the cell phone battery in my phone dies. I've still got numbers I can call. All I got to do is get to anybody's phone. If I've got to share it with somebody I trust. I've got to stop throughout my day and ask for direction. And I've learned to do that on a fairly regular basis. I love the line in the big book in the 10th step. It says, we've entered the realm of the Spirit. And I love that. Into the world of the Spirit, it says. That means I can turn around and walk out whenever I want to. If I entered it. This is like a door. But the Spirit is so neat. The Spirit is so neat. The Spirit is everywhere. And I'm not here to show you a bunch of other literature that's not a literature, but let me share you what a very spiritual gentleman shared with me about the 10th step and the realm of the Spirit. I don't know if I got it. There it is. The spiritual life is the life of the Spirit in us. So when I cleared away the wreckage of the past, the Spirit came alive. I no longer needed to ingest that liquid spirit we call alcohol. The Spirit came alive. And I got fired up. Still am fired up about this deal. A life that sets us free to be strong while weak. To be free while captive. To be joyful while in pain. To be rich while poor. To be humble while living in the midst of a material world. That's the realm of the Spirit that we enter in the 10th step. And I've seen that stuff in my life. And I've lost jobs. I've been unemployed. I've worked part-time jobs for years. My father was dying of cancer. I moved back to Richmond. I got to be present with my father in his last days and got to see my first cousin die of this deal called alcoholism. Picked him up out of a jail in Fredericksburg and asked him, were you drinking? And he said no. And when he went to court, his blood alcohol level was twice the legal limit. And he died, not 6 months later. Because I can't give him sobriety. I can't even give myself sobriety. But I could be helpful. I could be an example. I could let him know that I no longer needed to drink. I understand it is thirst, because I had a thirst just like that for a long time. And so we go through these things, and despite what it looks like on the outside, with a home group and sponsorship and sponsoring guys and staying in the middle of AA, no matter what life is thrown at me, it's a whole lot better than what it looked like before you guys brought me to AA and I was stopped from my insane behavior. Good stuff. And I only get that on a daily basis. I'm convinced I get a daily reprieve. That means I've got a death sentence hanging over my head. And the governor has decided to give me another day while they look at my case. You know, whatever it is. You know. That's all a reprieve is. It ain't taking away the sentence. I'm an alcoholic. I've got a death sentence over my head. And I get a daily reprieve. Based on trying to get closer to that power that I need to live out there. I can do pretty good in here. Because you're my people. You're my family. Even though I didn't like you when I first came in, I fell in love with you. Because you knew something I didn't. You knew how to live out there because you'd found that spirit inside you that we all have. And as I go through this thing, you know, I'm blown away by the opportunity in prayer and meditation to read some of the stuff that I read and be influenced by wonderful people. I'm always blown away by reading Mother Teresa and her relationship with God. And if you think that's a straight line to God, please read some of the stuff she writes. It's no straight line. She was a human just like me, but gave her life in service to help the sick and suffering. My sponsor makes it real clear that I've been given the unique ability to help the sick and suffering alcoholic. Because we're the same. When I talk to them about drinking, they know what I'm talking about. And I can give them those wonderful gifts that were given to me. If they want to pick them up. They're nothing but spiritual tools, but I can't pick it up for the alcoholic. They've got to pick it up themselves. I wish that I didn't have to stand up here and share my story with you. Because I'm no expert on recovery, the big book, or the steps, or any of this deal. But I did it because I was asked. I'm sort of in a position, and I'm going to paraphrase St. Francis. He wrote a prayer now, 12 and 12, so maybe I can read some of his stuff. Or maybe we took it from him. And he talked about, I'm a paraphrase, he said, if I live in recovery about my daily activities, but when necessary, use words. And so, I rarely will share groups I go to unless it's my home group. Now, I want the people in my home group to know Bob on a real personal level. And I've got to remain open and transparent to the people that I trust in recovery, my sponsor and my home group. But if I'm going to visiting to other groups, I rarely will say anything unless called on. Because what's going to influence the other alcoholic is, what are they seeing me do? Am I cleaning up my after I get through with the meeting? Am I picking up my cup? Am I helping put the chairs away? Am I showing up early and shaking hands? Am I greeting people? Am I welcoming people at the meeting? Am I acting like somebody who knows, who has found a solution here in Alcoholics Anonymous? Am I practicing these principles in all my affairs, at my job and in my home? And I'll do it so imperfectly that it's incredible. I go home and I go, oh, geez, did I mess that up? And I go back and try it again the next day and try and make it better, no matter what it is. And I have a wonderful life today, and I don't know. I don't have to worry about why. I simply have to show up and do these spiritual actions, and my life will change because it has in the past. So wonderful to be with you tonight. So many people here that I know for many years, and I'm grateful for your sobriety and what you're doing and the sharing that goes on in this group. Thank you so much.